Shrink Wrap Radio number 498, Duct Tape Parenting, with parenting educator Vicki Hoeffel.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is author, speaker, and popular parenting workshop leader, Vicki Hoeffel. For more information about Vicki Hoeffel, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Before we go to the interview, I'd like to tell you about an upcoming Jungian event in Boston. The C.G. Jung Institute of Boston is dedicated to the study and dissemination of the psychological theories and methods originated by Carl Gustav Jung. The Jung Institute is a gathering place for self-discovery and for the exploration of Jungian-oriented thoughts and ideas. Now listen up, on April 1st and 2nd, it will be hosting its biannual visiting lecture series. For this spring program, the visiting lecture will be David Shane, and that's spelled S-C-H-O-E-N, author of The War of the Gods in Addiction, and I might add, a former guest on Shrink Wrap Radio, episode number 331. He'll be speaking on Friday night at the Jung Institute in Newton, Massachusetts, on The War of the Gods in Addiction, The Psychodynamics of Addiction Treatment and Recovery. Then on Saturday, there will be an all-day workshop held at Brandeis University's Mandel Center on the Archetypal Evil of Addiction in Fairy Tales, Myth, and Religion. For more information and to register, go to www.cgjungboston.com, and there you'll be able to check out their spring public programs lineup, find an analyst, check out the analyst and auditor training programs, become a sponsored friend of Jung. You will be able to friend the Boston Jung Institute on Facebook and follow them on Twitter. Hey everybody, I'm happy to report we have a new sponsor. As you know, I'm a longtime dream journaler. Penzu is the world's most popular journaling platform with over 1 million users for web and mobile. Write entries in a secure, password-protected place that you can access from anywhere. Sign up for free at penzu.com, spelled P-E-N-Z-U, or if you're an avid journaler, go to penzu.com/GoPro and take $5 off Penzu Pro with the discount code SHRINKWRAP. Now, here's the interview. Vicki Hoeffel, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you here. And I discovered as I was going through some of your bio material that we have something in common that may surprise you. You are a graduate of Wheaton College, and out of high school, I received a partial scholarship to go to Wheaton.
No kidding.
Really? Now, I didn't end up accepting that scholarship because I got a better one to go somewhere else.
Oh, good. Love the college and great memories there. So.
Well, that's good. So I would have had a good experience had I gone there?
You most definitely would have.
Well, that's good to know. So I'm really pleased to have you on the show. I've been reading or enjoying your two books, Duct Tape Parenting and The Straight Talk on Parenting. But before we go into those, why don't you take us through the highlights of your backstory? You know, where you grew up, where you went to school. Of course, we already did mention Wheaton. How you got interested in kids and parenting and all of that.
So I was born in Southern California and spent 10 years of what I consider a really blissful childhood. I was raised in a neighborhood with lots of kids, and so my experience was one of getting a lot of freedom, a lot of independence, a lot of outdoor play. And then we moved to Seattle, where I spent the next 8 years. And when I graduated from high school, which was pretty uneventful those years, not a whole lot going on, I decided that I really wanted to travel, and I have a little bit of a gypsy spirit. And so I spent years kind of trying to figure out what I wanted to do, but more importantly, what I didn't want to do. And so I had jobs ranging from being a journalist at a newspaper, to singing in a rock band, to working at a hospital, to serving, you know, drinks and tending bar. And with each experience, it got clear to me that if I was going to work for 20 or 25 years, I wanted to find my passion.
Yeah.
I really wanted to be excited about the work that I did. And then I got married at 28, and we decided to have kids a few years later. And it was that experience of being pregnant that kind of opened up not only my new career, but my passion, and made it obvious to me where I would spend the rest of my time and energy and work. And it happened because I had a dream when I was about 12 weeks pregnant. And
you're talking about a nighttime dream?
Yeah, a nighttime dream. It was more like an experience. And I woke up and I heard this voice saying to me, listen, we want to give you a glimpse into your life as a parent. And in one scenario, you're going to play the role of a Mary Poppins kind of mom. And in this scenario, I'm a very kind and patient and nurturing mother who catches her toddler writing on the wall, and instead of going ballistic, I say, gee, this is a wonderful teachable moment, and let me show you where the environmentally sound cleaner is, and I'll teach you about cleaning up after your messes, and we'll go to playgroup. And in this scenario, I thought, oh, hallelujah, if this is parenting, this is wonderful. And right behind that thought comes the voice that says, but that won't be your experience. In the next scenario, we're going to introduce you to what it will look like if you play the role of yourself. And I knew I didn't need to see the role. I am an opinionated, bossy, short-tempered, egotistical dictator. And I thought,
oh, I love it when people reveal their true selves.
Yeah, do I really need to see what it will look like in a relationship with my children? But in the same scenario with a beautiful little toddler who'd accidentally written on the walls, I am a lunatic. And I realized at that moment that I needed to get some training in parenting, that I would not be one of those parents who had a child and would magically turn into the best version of myself. And I didn't want to ruin the relationship with my kids. I wanted to enjoy my 18 years in the home with them, but more importantly, I wanted them to want to be in relationship with me when they left home. And I thought, if I don't do something, that's never going to happen.
What a remarkable dream. You know, I've taught about dreams when I was a university professor and been interested in them going way, way back. And your dream sounds like Dickens' A Christmas Carol.
Exactly. That's exactly what it felt like was, and you know, people don't believe me, but it was a very real experience for me, and it changed the direction and the course of my life on so many levels. So I woke up with this horrible sense that I had to do something. I went to the bookstore. A 12-year-old was behind the counter. I said, can you help me find a parenting book? And she looked at me like, a what? And she pointed to the section. And even at the time, which 27 years ago, there were too many books. And I thought, okay, do I go alphabetically? Do I go by philosophy? Is there a system to getting through all of this literature on how to raise a healthy child? And she's like, I don't know. You're on your own. And I went home in tears. And I decided I was going to have to come up with my own, at least starting point, a roadmap for how I was going to parent a child with two goals in mind, enjoying the time when they were in my home and ensuring that we spent time together as adults. And everything happened from there.
Well, it's interesting that you go to the bookstore and there are too many books. There are too many books on this topic. So how do we get from there are too many books, to I'm going to write my own book?
So it was, I've been teaching for 25 years, and the first thing I wrote was 4 years ago. So I'd been asked before and kept thinking, I don't have anything to add to the conversation. It's all out there. I'd much rather present and talk to parents in person. And I got a whole lot of feedback from parents in the Vermont area that said, this is really great for us because we can take a class with you, but we have relatives in Kansas and California and Iceland, and they don't have access to you. So how are we going to get this information to them? And in exactly the same moment, a publisher approached me and said, we've heard that you don't want to do a book. We've heard that you don't think you have anything to say, but we're going to ask you if you'll try it and share your thoughts on what you've been doing, and let's just see if there's a market for it. And there was. So,
wow, what a great story. And, you know, it's just so synchronistic that the interview that I did just before this one will come out a week before this one comes out, was with a fellow named Tom Bird, who runs workshops called Write from God. And as a young man, he felt he was communing directly with God. And so he went on to, as a result of his visions and so on, to create something for all those frustrated writers, that people that feel like they have a book in them, but they can't get it out. And he does weekend workshops in which he claims people write the whole book in a weekend.
Wow.
So, that's a little bit of a digression, but still it seemed like it's interesting, your experience and what he described. So somehow you got to Vermont. We started off in California. You said you did travel a lot. I lived for 2 years in New Hampshire and traded jobs and traded houses with another professor. And really, me and my family, we fell in love with New England. And yeah. And would have stayed if we could. So lucky you that. Yeah. And you're in Vermont now, as
yes.
I'm speaking to you.
I am in Lincoln, Vermont, way up in the hills by Middlebury.
Oh, wow!
It's been a beautiful place to raise the kids. It's a very strong community, and I was lucky enough that I was able to support myself doing nothing but teaching parent education classes and speaking. And I feel incredibly fortunate because I know that's often not the case, that you get parent educators who are juggling full-time jobs and families and still trying to give back to the parenting community. So whenever I speak, my thanks go out to the Vermont community for embracing a very different approach to parenting, but I think one that resonated with them. So,
I think so, because one of the things that struck me about New England was there's something of the early spirit of the country that survives there.
Yeah.
And it's really palpable.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, so that's wonderful. And there's something about your approach that I can see would resonate with that.
Definitely.
Yeah. Somewhere along the line, you got interested in Alfred Adler, and that was a surprise to me. I was exposed to Adler in passing in graduate school. You know, he got mentioned as one of the early circle around Freud, and so it was surprising to me what I could remember of his theories, which was very little. I didn't see the connection. So how did you get exposed to Adler, and what is it that you find in his work that supports your work or inspires it?
Inspires it. So when I, after my kind of dream and going to the bookstore and I didn't know where to start. I came home. I came up with these kind of five concepts that I thought would serve me well in parenting. And I took my little list of five. I went back to the bookstore and I said to the gal, listen, I'm looking for a book that talks about these five things. Can you at least point me in that direction? And she shook her head and said, I have no idea. So I looked at the bookshelf, and I consider myself a remedial everything. And I figured I would be a remedial parent. So I found the book with the brightest cover that had cartoons on it and was thin. And I picked it up and bought it. And it happened to be written by the Dinkmeyers. And the Dinkmeyers are students of Adler's work. And I knew when I read the book that it was a language that was familiar to me. The way that they talked about the relationship between parents and children and what our role as parents could be and the potential for an amazing journey with kids from zero until, you know, well into our 80s and 90s. I thought this is more about a lifestyle that includes parenting than it is about a book on how I'm going to control my kids so that they listen to me and mind me. And that excited me in a way that very few other things did. So I picked up as many books as I could find on Alfred Adler. I moved back to Seattle for a short time, and they happened to have a huge Adlerian community, which I tapped into. And I went to every workshop, every speech, I read every book that I could. And I realized that Adler was taking components from a very large psychology and making it very easy for parents to translate into their world of parenting. And so I focused all of my kind of early training in parent education around Adler's model, and it resonated with parents in a very common sense way. It was as if when I spoke about things that we could be doing with our kids, I could see the light bulb go on and parents start to nod like, you know, I always had a suspicion that it would work like this, but I never had the courage to try it. So I kind of felt like I was more introducing people to an established philosophy than I was introducing them to something new that was mine.
Well, what are some of the principles in Adlerian psychology that
resonate with me?
Yeah, or that you're applying in your work?
Not sure if you can. Oh, I'm sorry. Are you there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Good. Oh, good. Well, you froze, so I didn't.
That sometimes happens. Yeah.
Yeah. There are several things that resonated with me, and we could talk hours and hours about this topic. But in terms of parenting, it was this notion that everything happens within a social context. So when our kids are born, they're born into a family that is about relationships, but they don't know anything about them. So they have to learn everything about relationships based on the one they established with their parents. And that relationship becomes the blueprint for them as they move out into a bigger world. So it wasn't just that I was going to be in a relationship with a child. It was that this child was then going to translate everything that was happening and extend that out into the world. I love that notion. It speaks to me in a really deep way. The second was that children want to be independent, that there's a yearning deep inside of all of us to master our environment.
Amen.
And, yep. Right. And that kids don't need to be talked into pursuing independence, but they need opportunities to develop and master self-skills, social skills, and life skills. And as their parents, we have a chance to create environments in which they have 18 years in which to practice becoming independent and our ability to support them. I loved the idea that if you introduce children to a relationship that was built on dignity and respect, that they would not only give it to other people, but they would demand it from other people, which meant that as my children spent more and more time outside of the home, they would be much more savvy in terms of gravitating towards people who also embodied those qualities and would distance themselves from people who did not. So, in other words, they would be able to negotiate and navigate relationships with their peers in a much more thoughtful and savvy way.
And yet you were able to do this without lecturing them about that, I gather.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, one of the ideas that I took from Adler and kind of tweaked a little bit was this idea about feeding the weed. As parents, we tend to focus on all the things our kids do that drive us nutty. And when I work with parents, I say, you know, just write your list out of all the things your kids do that make you want to pull your hair out. And it's a sizable list.
Yeah, sure.
And we tend to focus all of our attention on those pesky behaviors. And we go to the store, the bookstores, and get online and read blogs to learn what strategies we can use to minimize those pesky behaviors. And they include timeouts and counting and punishing and bribing and consequencing. But what happens is we end up feeding those weeds, and those pesky behaviors get more embedded in our kids. They tend to grow. They tend to flourish. And nagging, reminding, and lecturing are at the top of the list in terms of parenting strategies. So I knew that I was going to make the problem worse if I depended on all of those strategies. So I spent a lot of time thinking about, well, if not that, then what?
Yeah.
How am I going to raise kids who are cooperative, respectful, contributing, capable, compassionate, flexible, resilient people if I can't just wag my finger at them and tell them that that's who they should be?
Yeah.
And so I spent a lot of years thinking about all the ways that a parent could accomplish that.
Yeah. And so all of that's condensed into your two books that you've written.
Yes.
Let's talk about the books a bit. And one of the things I noticed, particularly in the duct tape book, is you've got lots of examples, sort of like little scenarios that parents are likely to face. And so I want you to feel free to throw in here any examples that you have, or scenarios, or even recollections from your own parenting experience. And I'm assuming that your kids turned out well.
5 out of 5 are all high functioning. They're out on their own. They're in college or graduated from college. So, yeah.
It's good
worked
for you.
It's worked fairly well for us.
Good
yeah.
for you.
Yeah.
So, I especially like the title of the first book, Duct Tape Parenting. And, of course, duct tape is so useful for everything.
Everything.
And the cover illustration was very neat. It shows kind of 1950s style parents with duct tape over their mouth. So what are you getting at with that title and with that image?
So this came out at the same time that there was all the new literature about the dangers of micromanaging and helicopter parenting and hovering. And, you know, before the trend hit, I had this idea that instead...
Sounds like you have another presence in the room there with you who has a comment to make.
I guess.
What kind of dog is that?
It's a very large golden retriever. So let me see if I can go tend to you
okay.
real quickly. Okay.
Sure.
Thanks. All right. I'm coming, David. I'm coming. I'm coming.
Even your dog has the confidence to speak up. And
it's not actually my dog. I'm staying with friends right now. So
Oh. Yeah.
So I'm not. That was unexpected, but I think he's all right. And I left the door open, so I think he'll be fine. So the duct tape reference over the parents' mouths. So the book kind of comes out as we're recognizing that the micromanaging and hovering is not raising kids the way we would hoped. And what I had always imagined for myself as a parent is that instead of standing in front of my kids and saying, listen, I'm going to do everything I can to make your life enjoyable. I'm going to solve your problems for you and pick out your clothes and wake you up and cook your favorite breakfast and pack your lunches and make sure that you're not frustrated. It didn't seem like a very exciting life for a kid. So instead of standing in front of them, I would take one step to the right and a half a step back. My children could actually see then the landscape of the world that we were asking them to learn to navigate. I would be very close. I could still be engaged with them, but I wouldn't be controlling every aspect of their life.
Mm-hmm.
But I also couldn't be whispering in their ear, are you sure you don't want to wear the longer pants today? Are you sure you want to pour that much milk in the glass? Are you sure you've remembered your homework? So for me, as a person who has a tendency to want to boss the entire world, I needed to use something to help me keep quiet, and I went to duct tape. I literally pulled a roll of duct tape out 1 week, and I challenged myself to keep my mouth shut and watch how capable my kids could be if I let them. And because I can't be trusted, I couldn't keep my mouth shut without the duct tape. So I started pulling off pieces and putting them on the kitchen counter. And as my mouth would start to open, I would grab a piece of tape and put it over my mouth. And I learned amazing things after 5 days of keeping quiet about my kids that completely changed our lives. So the title of the book and that exercise are kind of the introduction to parents on getting good information, factual information about their kids and their abilities, instead of relying on their assumptions about what their kids may or may not be able to do.
Wow, wow. Such a dramatic example and thing for you to do. It's great. Yeah. And so you're selling lots of books and lots of parent education workshops. So I guess there's a real need out there, right?
I think parents are looking for an approach to parenting that offers them some foundational concepts, but allows room for them to incorporate their own values, their own perspectives, their own styles, and their own rhythms. And I think that's what this work has allowed parents to do, is combine those things together. And when that happens, I think their confidence increases. And when their confidence increases, they make more thoughtful parenting decisions. And then that benefits the entire family. So it's a little bit of a snowballing effect that I think we've certainly experienced in the work I've done over the last 20 years.
Yeah. And one of the ideas that I get from the book is that it's not the kids that need fixing so much as the parents.
Yeah. I think of myself as an advocate for the kids. And my job is to help parents understand how they're mucking things up at home. Because the kids really have just a few goals. They want to stay connected to their parents. They want to learn how to master their own world. And they want to be part of a successful community of people. They're curious and they're engaged and they're great problem solvers. And we have to create an environment where all of that can be fostered. So, yeah, the parents get I introduce a new perspective to them on perhaps the problems in the family are because of you and not the kids. And if that's true, the good news is you're in a powerful position to make dramatic change very quickly to the extent that you're willing to change what you do. And then that becomes the journey we take together.
Yeah, well, in fact, that reminds me of some key concepts from the world of psychotherapy, where therapists often tell their clients that the only person they can fix is themselves. And similarly, people often come into therapy complaining that the kid is the problem, particularly in family therapy, and that's come to be known as the IP, or the identified patient, with the implication that the identified patient often is not the true source of difficulties. So it seems similar to what you're saying about parenting.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's a culture that likes to blame the kids. And you get a lot of talk on the playground. Oh, you won't believe what my 5-year-old did, my 7-year-old did. And that's the reason that we're so stressed. And it seems absurd to me that as a community of adults, we're pointing the fingers at little children as if a 5-year-old can really bring down an entire family. Like, it's just not been my experience is that a 5-year-old can actually do that without a lot of help from their parent. So, I think sometimes it can be hard for a parent to say, wait a minute, I'm the problem. But there's such liberation in the idea that, well, if I'm the problem, it means I can change it quickly and I can change it for the long haul. I don't have to keep using my energy and my resources trying to manhandle this little child who's working against me. If I take all those resources and energy back and work on myself, that's where the impact is. So I think it's just helping parents recognize it might seem like a really difficult thing to do, but it can be a completely liberating and exciting new way of parenting.
Yeah, yeah. In many ways, you seem to be saying that parents assume too much responsibility and consequently feel burdened because they've taken on so much. And also, they take on too much self-blame.
Yeah. If you take on the responsibility of your child's life, and that really means their happiness and you're not successful every day, it's easy to start blaming yourself and shaming yourself and judging yourself. And your kids are watching all of that going on, and they begin to learn, wow, you know, maybe part of life is about judging yourself harshly and being unsatisfied with the job you're doing. And I don't think that's what parents want to model for their kids. So as we begin to give kids more responsibility for their lives and their emotional health, and we're there to help nurture and foster and guide a little bit, it allows us to be much more compassionate and encouraging with ourselves, which is then good for the children, because when we can give that to ourselves, when we can forgive ourselves, we can forgive our children. When we can admit that we made a mistake and move forward, we can extend that same grace to our kids. So it's a win-win for everybody when we start putting responsibility back where it belongs. My friend Rick Ackerley has a great saying about playing your position. And he talks about it in terms of education. But I think in parenting, it's that same idea. Listen, we all have to play our position. My child's position is to learn how to master their world. And my job is to be there as the support, not the person who maintains responsibility for it.
Mm-hmm. In the duct tape book, you've got a chapter titled Band-Aids on Bullet Wounds. What are you getting at there?
So parents will whip out a parenting strategy. So here's how it goes. You're struggling with your seven-year-old who won't sit quietly at the table. They get up 15 times. They complain about the food. And you've had it. You're at your wit's end. So you call your best friend, and she's like, oh, my gosh, I just read this great book. We tried it with Emily, and it worked. This is what you do. So you get your little notebook out, and you're taking notes like, yeah, this is what I'm going to do. Oh, this is great. Then what do you say? Okay, good. And you look at your kid, and you go, listen, buddy. There's a new sheriff in town. I've got a strategy to deal with the fact that you won't sit at the table, and we're going to try it tonight. And the kid's like, whatever. So you get your little book out. He starts making mischief. You do what your friend said, but it doesn't work. You're like, well, okay, maybe it was the strategy. Maybe my kid's different. Maybe they have blue eyes and her kid has brown eyes. So maybe I need to find it. So you go out and you read a blog post about it, and you try that. So our kids keep doing what they're doing, making mischief at the dinner table, and you bring an assortment of Band-Aids out to try and remedy this problem, and nothing works. And each time you try something and it fails, you question your ability to parent this very small child, which then throws you into a panic, because if you can't manage a seven-year-old, how are you going to manage a 15-year-old? And so we start to lose confidence every single time we whip out a quick Band-Aid to put on what we now consider a very large problem.
Mm-hmm.
And what I recommend is that the first thing that happens is we have to shift our mindset. We have to change our perspective. If you're using the same thinking with every strategy, you're always going to end up with a lousy result. So before you go get a new strategy, change your mindset about what you think the problem is. And in that moment, no matter what strategy you try, you're probably going to have more luck with it.
Well, what about that very example? The kid's getting up every 15 or every few minutes, leaving the table, and it's annoying. Or at least you think it's annoying.
Yeah.
I think it's annoying.
I do too.
What do we do?
So instead of the sit down or I'm going to take your plate, if you don't do this, you're not going to watch TV, I'll give you a sticker if you do, you come up with a reasonable solution that's based on the facts. So what do we want? We want a child who sits down at the table and eats with us. What do we know about people who are done eating? They tend to leave the table. That's a common sense idea. So we say to the kids, gee, how do you know when somebody's done eating? They say, well, they get up from the table. And you're like, exactly. So from now on, when you get up from the table, that means you're done eating. And so your plate's going to be taken away. If you want to eat, stay at the table. If you're done eating, leave the table.
I would assume this has to be done without anger, without resentment.
Absolutely. But when you're calm and you're thoughtful, and you're not threatening your child, and you're not trying to bribe your child, and it isn't a complicated strategy to manipulate your child, you can actually follow through with a very friendly attitude that says, sweetie, you're a choice. Nobody's forcing you to get up from the table. You could stay here and eat, or you could get up and leave. But when you leave, what it means is that you're done. So your plate goes away until the next meal. Now you have a child who's in the position for the first time to ask himself, well, how hungry am I when I go to the table? Yeah. And how much do I want to eat? And for the first time, that child is actually engaged in a thinking process about the mealtime and less about the shenanigans of getting up and having mom and dad try and convince him to sit back down. Now, all of that is done and it's very simple. So in my world with five kids, there were hundreds of opportunities for me to use very simple, very common sense strategies to help the kids learn something that I thought would benefit them, but would certainly also benefit me, because they were sitting at the table, we could enjoy each other's company, and we could take them out for dinner, which I wanted to do.
Yeah, great. Now, the table often is a battlefield with other sorts of battles. I'm thinking of 1, 2, 3-year-olds sometimes that parents get very concerned that they're not eating. They're not eating enough.
Yeah, they do.
I see you chuckling. You recognize this.
I do recognize. And I got to tell you, in my experience, children eat if given the opportunity and food is presented to them in an attractive way. And there isn't a lot of pressure from parents to eat, take one more bite, quit playing with your food, don't drop that on the ground. So instead of creating an environment where children are introduced from very early ages the pleasure of eating together as a family, it becomes a sideshow in which the child is the main attraction.
And how about the here comes the spoon, it's on a train, it's coming to your mouth, woo, woo, woo.
Yeah, and part of what I say to parents is, if you wouldn't do it with your best friend, don't do it to your kids. And that's directly from Adler's work, is, you know, the proper way of raising children is the way that we treat each other as adults. So you extend those same kinds of routines, systems, behaviors, manners, and make it appropriate to the age. But you don't get yourself into these pickles where everything has to be on a train ride, and then you have to juggle, and now you have to sit on the floor in a teepee to eat. It's like, listen, this is where we eat. This is how long we eat. This is how we eat. If you want to do it differently, you can leave the table. And kids are fairly smart. If what they want is to feed their bellies and be with their parents, they oftentimes get with the program because the alternative is a hungry belly and no conversation with mom and dad. So,
Being the maid is another one of your titles, suggesting what? And that may even be, I was going to say maybe that's even more the case with teenagers, but take us through it. Maybe it's not, it starts a lot sooner than that.
Yeah, it starts as soon as the kids stand up and they have two free hands, and the first two things out of their mouths are, I do, or I help. And we get in their way and say, no, it's too sharp, it's too hot, you're too messy, you're too slow. And just as a child's beginning to develop that cooperative nature, we say, no, go sit down, I'll do it for you. And by the time you have a 5, a 6, a 7-year-old, you are more maid than you are parent. Now, if you want to be the maid, go for it. I didn't want to be the maid. I don't find anything particularly interesting or engaging about that position. It's hard work and it should be a paid position. What I wanted to be was emotionally available to my kids. And if I was micromanaging their lives, if I was waking them up and picking out their clothes and getting them dressed and making their breakfast and cleaning up after them, and I wasn't paying attention to all of the growth and changes that were happening for them emotionally, because I was in the minutiae of life. So that was the first thing I figured out, was I don't want to be the maid. I want to be emotionally available. But I also knew that if I wanted to send out high-functioning adults into the world, that they were going to need 18 years to practice managing their lives and mastering all of these self-skills. And I thought, well, it's much easier to do it with a 2- and a 3-year-old because they want to do it than it is to wait on them for 5 or 6 years and then say when they're 7 and 8, listen, bucko, it's time for you to start, you know, chipping in and taking care of more things. And here's why. Because it's not the kids are resistant to helping. It's that they've been convinced that they don't have the ability to take care of themselves because a well-meaning parent has been making life easy for them. And instead of being appreciative and grateful and, wow, isn't this great? The only thing I have to do is go play. They start to doubt their ability to get themselves dressed and to get up with an alarm clock and to make breakfast without spilling and to remember their backpack. And that seems like not only a disservice to the kids at that age, but a missed opportunity in allowing our children to develop deep and profound confidence in their abilities to manage their own lives and then to contribute to the success of their families. So I came up with a motto: if they can walk, they can work. And from the get-go, my kids were involved in the running of the house and taking care of themselves. And we did it slowly over time so that they weren't overwhelmed. So it's one of the things I talk a lot about in terms of promoting independence and self-reliance is how does a busy family with multiple kids and jobs and outside commitments empower their kids to take on more responsibilities and still get out of the house on time? And believe it or not, there is a way to do it, but we have to kind of slow the process down and make it manageable.
Okay. Now, the entire second section of the duct tape book is focused on solutions. And you say it requires a leap of faith. What's the leap of faith that you're getting at there?
I think the leap of faith comes from switching your approach and your mindset. Instead of thinking that if you're not in control of the kids, everything will be chaos, there has to be kind of a disconnecting process where you begin to step back and allow the kids to step more actively into their lives. And that means things are going to be messier because they need time to practice. So it takes a leap of faith to not foster those fears that say, we're never going to get out of the house on time. They'll never eat anything healthy. They're never going to go to bed. They'll watch hours and hours of television. They'll beat their sister up. They'll pull the dog. Like, we have all these fears that keep us in that kind of micromanaging position. So when we're willing to change our approach, it means that you really have to be willing to take a leap that for a while things will be messy, but they will right themselves, that you will come to that sweet spot, that balance where you're engaged, but you're not over-involved.
Well, you just touched on something that I think troubles a lot of families, and that's conflict between the siblings, constant arguing, and how come he gets to do that and I don't, and, you know, why did she get that and I didn't get that? What's your recommendation for people who are in the midst of those sorts of struggles?
I think it's important, again, to go back to this idea about mindset. So parents often find themselves in the middle of the sibling squabbles. And so the kids now know that if they start to fight, they get their parents. And maybe they wanted their parents 15 minutes ago, but the parents were unavailable. Well, if we start fighting with each other, mom's going to turn the stove off and come out. We might get yelled at, but at least we get mom for a few minutes. So that's one of the reasons kids fight. They also fight because they're bored. They have nothing else to do. So imagine if you're a kid and you see all this activity in your kitchen. People are cooking and they're talking and maybe they're having a glass of wine and there's laughter. And you try and get in and somebody goes, no, get, just go play. We'll call you when dinner's ready. You're like, well, now wait a minute. There's a lot of action going on in there. Like, I want to be over there with you guys. And every time you try and find a place in that activity, you're scooted out. Well, when you get bored and you're not invited to the party, it's easy to pick a fight with your sibling because at least then the party moves towards you. So boredom is a big part of sibling rivalry. And I think the last piece is we don't teach kids how to be in relationship with people who have different personalities than them, that have a different temperament, who have a different rhythm. Instead, what we say to kids is don't fight, don't yell, don't hit. But we don't teach them the art of getting along with people that are not exactly like you. So one of the things we help parents do is figure out, if these were not your kids, but these were two people that had to coexist who looked at the world in very different ways, how would you help them do that? And suddenly they have six ideas on what they would do. And then we say, good, now go and try that with your kids and see what happens. And sure enough, the squabbles start to diminish. The kids begin to enjoy each other in a way they hadn't before. They're also being invited now to be more active in the family. And those few things are enough to minimize the sibling rivalry by 50, 60, 70%. So I think there are really simple solutions to that, but we oftentimes overlook them.
Let's step back a little bit and look at things societally and culturally. And you made reference to the fact that your early childhood was pretty idyllic. And it sounds like you had a lot of freedom and so on. The things have changed so much in my lifetime. Now, I've got four grandkids, and they're in the house all the time. If they're not being taken to this kind of lesson or that kind of lesson or a play date at somebody else's house. But they don't play in, they don't have enough yard to play out there. And you know, I'm contrasting that with when I grew up also in Los Angeles, as you did. And I used to ride my bike for miles and miles and miles as a, you know, 10, 11, 12 year old.
Yeah.
My parents didn't know where I was, but they didn't have to worry the way that we do today, or at least that we think we do. So is it harder today than it used to be, would you say? You know, we've got the drug problem, we've got all the electronic devices and so on. What do you hear from parents, and what do you...
Yeah, I tell you, it's tough being a parent right now. Truthfully, I'm glad my kids are grown, but that means now grandkids will be coming, and mm-hmm. so I'll be back in the trenches trying to figure out how to help out there. So technology is here to stay, and part of the problem is we have not figured out how we're going to deal with it as the adults, and I liken it to driving a car. If you had a 9-year-old who said to you, listen, I can reach the pedals and I can see over the steering wheel, so I want to drive, there's not one person, one adult who would go, wow, I should consider that. You'd say, listen, this is the way it happens. You got to be 16. You got to fulfill these requirements. You got to pass a test. Then you drive. There's no discussion. But with technology, we give kids technology and then wonder if we did it the right way. So it's a learning curve right now. I think within the next few years, we're going to figure out how to allow kids to be part of the digital age, but also limit their access to a global world at the touch of a key. So I think we're getting there. I think there's this idea that kids are more at risk outside of our homes than they really are. And so we try and minimize their exposure to what we think of as risks. And you can look at a playground now where nobody's allowed to jump or swing or any number of things. I'm not sure that children are more fragile than they were when we were growing up. I don't suspect that they're clumsier than we were. I suspect there's always going to be a part of the population, a percentage of kids who end up in the emergency room with a broken arm, whether there are plastic playgrounds or wooden ones or just trees in the background. So I think we're not accessing common sense some of the time. And in an attempt to keep kids safe, we've gone over the edge. Mm-hmm. In terms of safety from predators, a good friend of mine and someone I work with, Gavin DeBecker, who wrote The Gift of Fear and Protecting the Gift, makes a very strong case that it isn't the outside world that the kids need protecting from. It's education, how to trust their instincts and intuition, and how to communicate with their parents in an honest way, and for parents to listen to kids when they come to them with a fear about an uncle who is being too friendly or, you know, Johnny's big brother who wants to get me in the room alone, and to take those concerns seriously. I think that the conversation is becoming a little bit more balanced than it was even 10 years ago. And it is my great hope that it continues to become more balanced and that parents move a little bit closer to Lenore Scanese's kind of, you know, let them get dirty and let them fall and let them go a little bit further than you want them to go, because they can handle it. Okay. If you teach and you educate. So, yeah.
Do you think that, I don't know to what extent parenting skills are taught in the schools. I suspect not very much, if at all. Do you think that the kind of teaching that you do should be in the schools, either at the primary, secondary, or college level?
Yes, I think it's the same as teaching kids about finances starting in the second grade, because money's such an integral part of our lives as adults, and nobody teaches kids about finance. It's the same with parenting. But here's what I know as a parent educator. Every person who finds themselves pregnant for the first time thinks they will do it different. And that's why you have kids, is because you can look around at the chaos and think, but I'm going to be different and my relationship will be different. It's usually by the time the personality emerges in the child at about two that my phone starts ringing. And those same parents who said, I don't need this, say, I have no idea who's in the house with me anymore. It went from a lovely one-year-old to an unbearable two-year-old, so now what do I do? So do I think there's a place for foundational pieces of psychology about interactions and relationships and fostering independence? Absolutely. Do I think that information would help as those kids grew into adults that were going to be parents? Absolutely. I just don't think it's an important part of any educational model curriculum right now, which is, you know, unfortunate. So.
Now, you went on to write a second book after, you know, not being sure that you could write a first book. And so you went on to write a second one called The Straight Talk on Parenting, a no-nonsense approach on how to grow a grown-up. what was the impetus to do that? And what's the unique aspect of this second book?
I think the unique aspect of the second book is this idea that parents have that a parent educator or someone who writes about parenting or says that they're an expert somehow has some magical power that they don't, which is complete nonsense. So the book was really about, listen, when I work with parents on a client, on a coaching level, I'm going to tell you everything I do and then you can do it and you won't need to hire me. That was really what my goal was, is okay. If you knew the questions to ask that I ask you, you would need to hire me. And that, I hope that every parent comes to the point where they realize that they're the real experts in their children's lives. So I map out how I work with the client and what questions I ask, and then how those questions lead a client to solutions that work for them. And then I provide stories on how different parents came up with, you know, use those questions. But more importantly, it's about helping parents understand that parenting is not about what happens when your kids are living at home between the ages of 0 and 18. Your job, our job, is to reconcile the fact that we are living with toddlers, but we are raising adults. And that means we have got to change the way in which we spend our time with children. Because right now, what we're looking for is compliance and control. And what we want to be focused on is raising children who are engaged, thoughtful, curious, cooperative, responsible, and resourceful. And that is not happening if the only thing you're worried about is children who are polite and have manners and eat what you put in front of them and never talk back. So a lot of the work right now that I'm doing is about helping parents reconcile that the meltdown their four-year-old is having, it's important that they not only deal with that moment, but they think about the impact this moment will have on their future 24-year-old. And that, for me, is really exciting work right now.
Well, you know, that is such an articulate statement that I think is a perfect close to our interview. And I'll be sure to let people know the link to your website.
Thank you.
So, Vicki Hoefel, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
I really resonate with Vicki Hoefel's down-to-earth approach. She didn't reference cognitive behavior therapy, or CBT, in our interview, but if there's one thing that behaviorism has taught us, it's that parental attention is a strong reinforcement for kids. It's led to the widespread advice, catch 'em being good. It's often said, but not as often put into practice. As Vicki points out, paying attention to the annoying stuff kids do is like pouring water on weeds in the hopes of getting rid of them. And we know that even negative attention and disapproval can be reinforcing. At least the kid is getting some parental attention. Vicki's approach certainly includes that wisdom, but also goes far beyond it. I also agree strongly with Vicki's observation that kids have a tremendous drive for competence. They don't want to be shown how to do stuff as much as they just want to do it themselves. I had a taste of that with one of my young granddaughters when I was showing her how to do something on my iPhone, and she just brushed my hand out of the way somewhat impatiently, saying, "Let me do it." I agree that kids are capable of doing more than we often think. I'm reminded, too, of the early intervention story of the person who sees babies floating down the river and, instead of jumping in to save them, runs upstream to stop the person who is throwing them in the river. In other words, early intervention is likely to be most impactful, and parents have the opportunity to grow grown-ups. Vicki's teaching may lead to some empty therapy couches down the road. I recommend both of Vicki's books strongly. The titles, again, are Duct Tape Parenting, A Less is More Approach to Raising Respectful, Responsible, and Resilient Kids, and her new book, The Straight Talk on Parenting, A No-Nonsense Approach on How to Grow a Grown-Up. As always, I'd be most grateful if you would use our Amazon.com affiliate widget in the right-hand sidebar on our site to order one or both of these excellent books.
Hi there, my name's Faye. I'm from London in the UK. I decided to make a $5 donation to Dr. Dave's podcast because I'm learning a lot from it and spent about $40 a month on books and learning. So, hey, why not $5 to such an interesting podcast? Thanks so much for doing the work you do.
Thank you, Faye, for your donation and your call to the thousands out there who are not donors to join you and others who do provide financial support. It's greatly appreciated. I'm happy to announce that we do have some new donors since the last episode, and my thanks go out to Rebecca Nicole, Taylor Sanders, and Denise Mitchell. There are no new transcripts to announce today, however. Time's running out on the Zur CE credits discount. Now through March 31st, you can get 20% off by entering the discount code ZUR180 at checkout. Just go to zurinstitute.com/dvannies.html. And for those of you who do not know how to spell my name, it's VANNUYS. As you may have noticed, I've been putting up 5-minute or so video clips of some of my recent interviews, and I've started to make full-length videos of some of these interviews available on my Shrink Wrap Radio YouTube site. Up until quite recently, I've assumed that my listeners would not be interested in full-length video. Please let me know if that's an option you'd be likely to use. In fact, to make it easier for you to let me know, I've put up a poll in the right-hand sidebar on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. Now scroll down past all the book ads there on the right, and you'll see the poll. And what it says is, are you likely to go to my Shrink Wrap Radio YouTube site to see full-length videos of some of my interviews? Yes or no? So that would be an excellent way for you to give me the feedback that I need here. It's been some time since I've posted a poll. Now, speaking of these videos, if you are interested in knowing more about me and how I got into podcasting and so on, Australian listener and podcaster Amy Fellman made a full-length video of her interview with me. She was very successful in making me comfortable and drawing me out. You can find a link to that full-length video by going to the In the Media tab on the Shrink Wrap Radio site. Actually, there is a link to the audio only and another to the video plus audio, depending upon which you prefer. And I also highly recommend Amy's psychology podcast, which is called We All Wear It Differently. Finally, for any of you who are not already members of Audible.com, my favorite audiobook service, and as long as I've been advocating for them, I don't know if I've got any listeners out there who aren't already members, but if you aren't, I strongly recommend that you become one. And my recommendation today is a book my wife turned me on to. I haven't finished it yet, but I'm enjoying it, and although it is fiction, there's definitely a psychological side to it. The audiobook I'm referring to is titled The Humans, and it's by Matt Haig. Here's what they say about it on the site: a clever, heartwarming, and darkly insightful novel about an alien who comes to Earth to save humans from themselves. When an extraterrestrial visitor arrives on Earth, his first impressions of the human species are less than positive. But as time goes on, he starts to realize that there may be more to this weird species than he's been led to believe. Eventually, the narrator sees hope and redemption in the human's imperfections and begins to question the very mission that brought him to Earth. Let me play you a little sample.
I ate the vegetable stir-fry. It smelt like Basidian body waste. I tried not to look at it, so I looked at Isabel instead. It was the first time that looking at a human face was the easiest option. But I did need to eat, so I ate. When you spoke to Gulliver about me going missing, did he say anything to you? Yes, she said. What was it that he said? That you came in about 11, and that you'd gone into the living room where he was watching TV, and that you'd told him that you were sorry you were late, but you'd been finishing something off at work. Was that it? There was nothing more specific? No? What do you think he meant by that? I mean, what I meant by that? I don't know. But I have to say, you coming home and being friendly to Gulliver, that's already out of character. Don't I like him? Not since 2 years ago. No. Pains me to say it, but you don't act very much like you do. 2 years ago. Since he got expelled from Perth. For starting a fire. Oh, yes. The fire incident. I want you to start making an effort with him. Afterwards, I followed Isabel into the kitchen, putting my plate and cutlery in the dishwasher. I was noticing more things about her. At first, I had just seen her as generically human, but now I was appreciating the details, picking up things I hadn't noticed, differences between her and the others. She was wearing a cardigan and blue trousers known as jeans. Her long neck was decorated with a thin necklace made out of silver. Her eyes stared deep into things, as though she was continually searching for something that wasn't there, or as if it was there but just out of sight. It was as though everything had a depth, an internal distance to it. "How are you feeling?" she asked. She seemed worried about something. "I feel fine." "I only ask because you're loading the dishwasher." "Because that's what you are doing."
"Andrew, you never load the dishwasher. You are, and I mean this in the least offensive way possible."
So the book goes on for another 8 hours. The author is British, and so is the reader, who does a delightful job, I think, and as you heard. If you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription. by going to audibletrial.com/shrink.
Hi, my name is Judy from County Cork, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Wow, that brings back fond memories of one of my last trips to Ireland, and it's been way too long. Now let's go to some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Donna, who writes, "Thanks, Dr. Dave. Hey, I've only just discovered you and your podcast. I really enjoy listening to them. Lucky for me, I have a long commute, so they are perfect. They are so good, it feels like I'm sitting in the room with you and your guest. Hey, I have only just started my recovery. I truly hope I can stay on course. Thanks again for being out there and putting up a great show and such a volume of work, too. I hope you keep going for many more shows and years. Regards, Donna." Well, Donna, I'm so glad to hear that you're on a good path with your recovery, and I think that listening to Shrink Wrap Radio will perhaps reinforce that. So keep listening. And next we hear from Beck in Melbourne, Australia, and she writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Just a note to say thank you from the bottom of my heart for the work you do to bring all this incredibly valuable information to the rest of us out in the ether. I have just subscribed to a monthly donation because I would love to see your work continue, and I will be devouring your archives, soothed by your thoughtful, inquiring manner for a long time to come. I found your podcast recently during a difficult time of trying to work through some of my own childhood and adult trauma and figure out why I developed and still have fibromyalgia after 20 years and why 20 years of talking therapy has still not reduced my pain or lowered my tendency to be triggered at the drop of a hat. Your podcast interviews with Bessel van der Kolk, Siburn Fisher, Pat Ogden, Daniel Siegel, and Stephen Porges have helped me to put together a picture of my dysregulated nervous system as my body responding to protect me from overwhelming traumas. I found a new level of self-compassion that is a great relief, as well as a potential new direction for me to explore in terms of work or research when I complete my Master of Social Work later this year. Most profoundly, I finally believe that there are some therapeutic modalities for me to try which might finally help me to let go of the pain by turning down my nervous system's hypervigilance. For all this, I can barely thank you enough. I know fibromyalgia is mentioned by a number of your guests in relation to trauma, and if you think there is enough material for an episode or interview with someone who has specialized in this area, I would be thrilled. I gather I'm one of many fans from Down Under, so cheerio from Beck in Melbourne, Victoria, and keep up the brilliant work." And that's signed Beck. Beck, it's great to hear from you, and I'm so glad to hear that you found encouraging resources here. And if you or any listener has a suggestion of some other guest who would be particularly expert in relation to trauma and the brain and fibromyalgia, do write and let me know. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail using our app or our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Vicki Hoefel, for her insights into parenting. My next guest will be Finnish psychologist Antti Revonsuo, who has a theory about the evolutionary value of dreams and who will also be a keynote speaker at the upcoming International Association for the Study of Dreams conference in the Netherlands this coming June. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.